I've got this fantasy red dress now. I wish I was wearing my red dress. It's so lovely to be here and to be with these three women that I've been working with over the last year. Pavilion Poetry is a new venture, and the three poets that are reading this evening, Mona Arshi, Sarah Corbett, and Eleanor Rees, launched the books in spring this year. I'm very grateful to Anthony Cond and all the team at Liverpool University Press, not least the interns who worked closely with the writers on the books, for their passion and professionalism, all the P words, really in bringing a new home to poetry in the UK. And as I was thinking about this, I felt that actually having a place to write from is an important thing. It's important, it's as important for a poet as having a reader to write to. And I know that the press is absolutely committed, as am I, as an editor, to nurturing voices that can experiment and grow as their careers continue to develop. One of the things that I constantly remind myself as I meet new writing in workshops with students, judging competitions, reviewing, or even when meeting my own words on the page as I write, is that writing that will last challenges us, asks us to reframe our expectations, and provokes in us something new or surprising. Jacqueline Rose, in her recent book, Women in Dark Times, has argued movingly that the struggles that we make with that which is most recalcitrant and unsettling in ourselves are a vital part of a struggle for the better political futures that we want. And in publishing new writing, which feels like a huge privilege, I'm reminded again that poetry matters, and that its complex way of thinking and feeling has a vital part to play in how we live our lives and how we imagine and how we exist in the world. So it's a real delight to introduce, in turn, the three poets that we've published this year. And I'll start with our first reader, Eleanor Rees. Eleanor Rees is the author of Andraste's Hair, published by Salt in 2007, which was shortlisted for the Forward Prize for Best First Collection and the Glenn Dimplex New Writers Awards. She's also the author of the fabulously titled Eliza and the Bear, published in 2009. Blood Child is her third collection. I've known Eleanor for many years, and she's remarkable for the generosity of her collaborations with other writers, musicians, and artists. She works to commission as a poet. Eleanor's worked extensively as a local poet in the community, and she's recently completed a PhD from the University of Exeter. She's also one of the five Versopolis Emerging European Poets. She lives in Liverpool, and I'm delighted that she's here to read tonight.
Oh, thank you, Darren. It's wonderful. It's a huge privilege to be here this evening reading from this new book. I'm going to read, all my poems will be from Blood Child itself, and I'm going to begin with a long poem, the title poem, which is called Blood Child. I'm not going to say too much about this, just to say it's very much a winter's poem rather than a summer poem, so imagine that it's snowing and it's very cold. Blood Child. Behind the house, a single stark tree, cherries still ripe, though it is midwinter. Bleached fruit on bare branches ooze like a cut thumb, each drop in slow motion falling onto hard soil. Inside, in a silent kitchen, on a metal table, apples curdle in a handmade bowl. Mulched bills ferment on varnished pine. In the garden, past the pond, the tree stretches like spilt ink, over tall, bent back, to eye a yellow crescent crisp in a fold of cloud. Black night glass reflects back the dead centre of a pupil. Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. On the stained glass window of the empty hall, red flecks fall, become ice as hail chimes angular to grey pebble dash, and dripping blood begins to take a form of a red ice child creature, gleaming like a ruby, standing silent at the wind-open door. The storm glowers behind the outline like a tiger. It roars, but she cannot hear him. You are not there to listen for her. The hallway is an empty blue. Books rattle in their case. Outside she stands like death. The door closes in her face. Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. Where are you? Are you asleep in bed upstairs or running breathless down the street? Maybe you don't live here anymore. Are you away in a cottage in the woods or on a moving train, window patch black smacked with yellow? Are you underwater, swimming through the last swathe of the tide? Are you listening for wolves at the back of your mind? Are you in a hospital, deep under sterile silver and nurses blue? Yes, where are you? Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. Oh, mother has gone missing. She has gone to ground. I sing, abandoned at the outskirts of the town. Oh, mother has gone missing. She has gone to ground. I sing as wolves prowl around. Oh, mother has gone missing, she has gone to ground. I sing a shining knife in hand. Oh, mother has gone missing, she has gone to ground. I sing full-voiced with the choir of the land. Yes, where are you? In the garden, the tree flinches, scratched by rats, the storm sifted from the watercourse. Small muscular movements smatter on a shield of dark. Cherries gone, turn to child, who crouches on the front step, red ice storm creature, as bloodied as prey, silent as an unknown song, as the snow comes along. The tree sighs and bows and stretches again, under tall, copying the hill, bends down. In the house on the living room floor, a wool rug turns to water. Small boats sail to wind-fed shores. Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. Are you underground, in the cellar or soil, hiding in the mulch and leaves? Are you rooted in the dirt or rolled up in the rock? Heart beating slow, lost light in your eye? Or are you in the woodpile, kneeling under last year's pine, needles sticking into folded skin? Or are you gone from here, aloof in the wind like a wild goose journeying south from darkness, garden soil untended, land unturned? Are you unbecome, laid bare in the last light of winter sun? Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. In the kitchen, the tap drips a slow red drop onto stainless steel clouded with washing up sods. White light filters in through an open window. Outside the garden heaves in the wind, one breath. A figure runs along the alley, a child or fox, but closer, starry red, her bright face at the glass. The tree paws the soil like a horse, a branch turning over loose earth with a sway, a lilt, a whip, a crack, but only as far as its roots will allow. What is the spell that holds them still? Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. It is the spell of silence, child. She doesn't speak to the house. It is the spell of silence, child. She doesn't breathe to the frost. It is the spell of silence, child. She doesn't sound in her throat. It is the spell of silence, child, so she doesn't feel the loss. Yes, where are you? And the rats run to the river, and the dogs run to the river, and chimneys spark like kindling. From far west flickers a firestorm through the town, soot and smoke, sea buckling in distance, a hot avalanche across frost-crested rooftops. The red ice blood creature waits on the doorstep, listens for a high-pitched wail from the garden, fat of a song. The tree is whipping hard against the fence. It cannot run. Branches stacked one on one form a shield. The fire comes. Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. The house raises its head, tips back its neck. In the hall, a vase falls south, a ship in a storm. Empty glasses smash their silence inside the kitchen cabinets. A knitted doll tumbles down stripped wood stairs. And underneath, in foundations, bricks plow down into sandy earth like a rudder, and the bow of the building turns for the river. The roof flips like a flag, and the whole house dredges through molten earth, which parts like waves, splitting the garden wall, tarmac road. Inside the schism, tree roots hang like curls. Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. In the wall of mud, each frond turn forms a human face, oval-shaped, which calls out, "Where are you?" Fire on the horizon crumples church towers as the red ice blood creature starts to drip and ooze. A snowman after snow has gone. Warmth sighs the size of her small girl's shape and becomes a spring, a stream, a brook, a tidal river shifting mud and roots to form a gorge with wooded sides. Through leaves two figures run, girl and woman, each a ruby mark amongst a balsat green. Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. And their melting blood flattens the fire. At the crest of the ridge, as large as the sun, lamp-lit town below like embers in the hearth, steam in the street now quiet as cold, the woman who was a tree reaches out a hand to catch a crescent painted onto navy cloth, tilts it back and forth, then picks up her child, the red ice blood creature, and pours her like lava into the crust of the moon, staining it sticky, and the light spills like wine over the valley. And a single cherry tree in a garden behind an empty house. The fruit still ripe, though it is midwinter. Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. Thank you. So I'm just going to read a couple of shorter pieces. This poem, again, is set at night, and the moon is a recurrent theme throughout these poems. This poem's just called Full. Moon-raked, unable to sleep, I wake landlocked and unwilling to shift beyond my own horizon into a fall of snow or a tired embrace. Or a landscape of ships and sails, old relics on the shore, or your hand again, or the draw and wreck of the sea on coastal plains that is lapping even now. 2:35 a.m., late, unearthed and deep in a city's sleepy silence that's remarkable and unsung. no trains, no rush of cars, just this flat moment, heavy in the black, cloudless sky. The church on the hill squats in a square of shadow under the moon-ridden moments of shifting white. And somewhere inside, perhaps near the altar or in the pews, she is sitting alert to our dreams, hat on for Sunday, hunched forward in prayer. The door creaks as I enter, sleep frenzied and aware of the turn of her neck. Her startled eyes in the shadows witness my nighttime intrusion into the life of the dark. Okay, I'm going to read a couple of poems from a sequence of six poems, which is called Arne's Progress. What you need to know is that Arne is half man and half eagle, and he's taking a journey across the River Mersey and through the landscapes of Liverpool. And we first meet him in the middle of the river in a very small boat, in a coracle, in fact. This is called Crossing Over. As he sails the coracle of willow and skins, his bird eyes mirror the moon behind cloud. Spring tide drags west, but he paddles east. Water seeps through the stitching, a little like blood. Arne buckles his weight over the hump of the river, the small craft alive on the back of the wave, as he waits for the hook to reveal his possessions. Pot of ink, hunk of amethyst, a drawing of a storm framed in gold and made of light. He wraps these in Hessian, a swaddle of ornament, pulls up a line as the clouds move south. Rain simpers along the Welsh mountains, calling, go home now, find a dent in the earth and burrow in. He sings to the wind, rows the harrying waters. Across the estuary, a ship bell starts to ring. An Irish ferry slows its entry into the detritus of objects on the river awaiting the storm. A broken slate, rat's corpse, torn lace, a mirror. The thought of the future in a golden case, open to spray, velvet inlay, sodden with salt. A handful of red hair floats like a jellyfish, caught in the to and fro, in the froth of the drag. A cormorant extends its shining black feathers as he walks ashore on the bone of the wing. And arriving in Liverpool, he travels up to the Anglican Cathedral, and the cemetery that surrounds the cathedral is St. James's Cemetery. I've renamed it St. James's Infirmary because it is a cholera graveyard. In the graveyard, the children have cholera. They lie on stretchers, on iron-framed hospital beds. He is mopping their foreheads with mildew, parchment, moss, quietness and winter rain, which he did until just before dawn, long hours of talk, laughter, occasional song. The light from the moon made everything white. He gave them gifts of fresh river water, and they drank with their mouths as silent as stars. Small hands cupped around the tankard, milk teeth tapping on the cold edge of copper. Okay. And on he goes, further into Liverpool, but we'll leave him travelling on. And I'll just conclude with a final poem, which is after the ballad The Cruel Mother, if any of you know it. I've been working with a folk singer called Emily Portman, and she's been sort of telling me lots of different folk tales and stories about ballads. And we were very interested in how often these women get punished for doing things vaguely transgressive. And this is kind of answering back to some of the themes in this idea of the cruel mother. Amongst the leaves I lie, teeth bared, raw as the sundown. Scattered skins hang on the trees, like prayer flags. I am demon, I am the bad one. I am the wild, edible bark. You bit my tongue and made me roar. I will baron you, bust up your eye, scratch at damp dirt with these claws. Where are you? Nest of twigs, den in the woods, hut with smoke at the door. The home burns its riches. My young slide onto the forest floor like eels. They writhe. Branches hold them, swaddle small forms with dirt. They call on into the blistering night, sky bubbles and cores. Trees like dogs lick at the sun, wide as horizon, large as moon. The oak I lean on leans back, bark like a spine. Over the fence on the well-kept lawn, I hear them talk. Oh, there is nothing to be done, nothing, nothing to be done. And I hear him say, it is not his fault. And they all agree, it was all up to me. In the greenwood, I sing to hope of rain. I sing to blood which falls and pours. In the garden, they sit, drink wine and thunder, wonder where I have travelled towards. But don't stand and search, but talk, and worse, they sigh. Oh, there is nothing, nothing to be done. I will eat these babies, cook them one by one. The greenwood says I should stay the night. The greenwood casts a curse on those who say nothing can be done and leave me, a wildcat, to run into their sleep in hot, damp beds, into their eyes in the dark. I am a clawed mother, and he will not have them back. Oh, the cruelty he weighed on me. Thank you.
The next of our poets, Mona Arshi, was born to Punjabi Sikh parents in West London, where she still lives. Mona initially trained as a lawyer and worked for Liberty, the human rights organisation, for several years, undertaking test litigation under the Human Rights Act. She began writing poetry in 2008, not so very long ago, really, and received an MA in creative writing from UEA. She was on the Complete Works Programme, a scheme funded by the Arts Council, and in 2014 she was joint winner of the Manchester Poetry Competition. The book she'll read from tonight, Small Hands, has recently been shortlisted for the Forward Prize, and I'm really delighted again to welcome her.
The lion. How unstable and old he is now. Lion like God has snack sent up by means of a pulley. Although you can never master the deep language of lion, I am made dumb by the rough stroke of his tongue upon mine. Nowadays I make allowances. We lie together and I hear the crackle of his bones, and when I bring myself to open my eyes, he weeps, his pupils resembling dark, embroidered felt circles. Sometimes I think all I am is a comfort blanket for his arthritic mouth, but many evenings he'll sit twisted behind the drapery, solving my vulgar fractions with nothing but his claws. Lion and I break bread. I tend to his mane, and he sets 1,000 scented fuses under my skin. He starts undressing me under the sweetening stars. Please, girl, he mews, this might be the last time I will see how the thin light enters you. Hello, everyone. I thought I'd start with a poem. I'm really delighted to be here at Ledbury. It's the first time I've read here, and I was really lucky. I was here in May, and I was funded to do a voice 5-day voice workshop with five other poets, and it was transformative and wonderful. So it's really nice to be able to have that experience and now be reading here today. As Darren said, this is my first book, and I thought I'd say a little bit about the book because it is my first book, and I used to be a lawyer, as you know. And many poets will tell you how painfully difficult it is to articulate what a book is about. And while I was writing these poems, about 3 years ago, my brother passed away, and very suddenly and very tragically. And so I feel like slightly unfairly I had to deal with, in my poems, I had to deal with his death and write a written about his death. And there are, in the heart of the book, in the centre of the book, there are, I suppose, elegies to my brother. And so there are poems that deal with loss, but this is also a book, I think, that where death shuffles alongside life, which the poems contain ordinary sources of joy as well. I'm really interested in form. I love the ballad, and you heard Eleanor's lovely ballad earlier, and I'm going to read one. So in that spirit, I thought I would read a variety of poems from the book, just to give you a flavour. There are a lot of birds in my book. In fact, I think nearly every single poem has a reference to a bird or a feather or hands. So I'm going to read you Hummingbird. Hummingbird. Ask the stems in the glass to bend. Let your fingers fly, a momentary grasp. Slip into spaces, surge in and out of folds where breasts begin to curve and rise. Be God. Press your curing skin to mine, dissolve and pronounce me. Let my eyes fall out and embed in the carpet, rooting. My hands arrange the air for you, braiding. Reluctant sun at the window, open your eyes, burn through the haze with your severe love. Slide open the bone zip of my spine, anoint each rigid peak, take my limbs and fold me over. Here's my mouth, hummingbird, linger there and hold my breath. I'll read another couple of bird poems later. So I've got two daughters, and my daughters are always asking me to write about them, and I haven't actually written about them directly, but of course they are all over the book. They're in the book. You don't need to look very far. But there is one particular poem which got me to the threshold of the poem. Was my daughters losing their teeth when they were about 6 years old. And because they're twins, they started losing teeth together. And there was one point when they were about six and a half where both of them lost two teeth in the space of an hour, and I've got a thing about blood, and they've sort of... Anyway, so it was pretty horrific, and amazing, actually, losing teeth, but also quite horrific. So this is the daughters. My daughters have lost 236 teeth and counting. They possess so many skills. They can craft sophisticated weaponries, such as blowpipes, lances and slings, and know what the sharp end of a peacock's feather is for. Last month, they constructed a canoe and saved the Purdue Mephistopheles from extinction. They may not know what the bird in the hand is worth noting, but have learnt never to bleed on any of the auspicious days and are aware that pleasure is a point on a continuum. I fear they will never make good brides. They are too fond of elliptical constructions and are prone to lying in the dirt, reading paragraphs in the clouds. Their shadows are long. They know many things, my girls. When they are older, I will teach them that abundance and vulcanization are bad words. When they sleep heavy. I go into their rooms and check their teeth. And if you want to know what a sharp end of a peacock's feather is for, you have to buy the book, because it's detailed diagrams am I allowed to say that if it's not true? Yeah, detailed diagrams about what you're supposed to do with one. So that's the daughters, spirited daughters. There's lots of spirited daughters in the book. I'm an Indian poet, and I sort of sometimes feel that there's an obligation that you have if you're from a particular place to write about particular things, like, you know, am I expected to write about saris and mangoes or arranged marriages? And I sort of didn't want to go there. And, you know, because I thought, well, everyone expects me to write about these things, why should I write about them? And then, you know, the book's published and it's everywhere. You know, I've even got garam masala in one of the poems. It's really odd. So, but I do really love pomegranates. And if you've never had pomegranates in a salad, I do recommend them. And so I wrote a praise poem, an ode to a pomegranate. Ode to a pomegranate. Sweet sequins turn strange and delicate, such feverish capsules, Sita's shy dowry stones and rubies, brilliant rubies, vials of pure narcotic, secreted by fragments of daybreak, fat drops of rain captured in your tiny pink purses. You are such found things, many estranged souls, unborns ticking in blisters of heat, our own misremembered firelit tongues, or chambers of quartz songs, and an infant globe in our palms shows us the vastness of things, turmoil of the earth. Who knows what memory is stored in its skin, like the tips of my mother's fingernails, opening, cleaning, intimate with you. And if you buy a book, you'll get a free pomegranate. No, it's not true. I can't say that. Something a bit different. Okay, this poem, bear with me, is called Large and Imprecise Baby. Let's just go with it. I gave birth to a large and imprecise baby, which I'll admit was quite a shock, given my fine, distinct bones, and on account of the fact that I didn't even go to term. One of the mothers in the playgroup gasped when she saw me unbuckling the buggy and heaving him into the sandpit. He never cries or emits any sound except when immersed in water. Sometimes I take him to the coast where he lies, passively feeding from the bottom of the ocean. I ask that he be referred to a consultant, the baby watched and pushed raisins into his mouth whilst Dr. Frankel measured my head with a cold metal instrument. It's not him, it's you, he says, eyeing me suspiciously, stroking his beard. Outside, I smooth myself down, kneel to his level, and decide to kiss my boy. As my face nears his feeble mouth makes a jittery noise like a broken gull or the scrape of a heavy chair, just as a thin rain starts to fall. I did promise you some more bird poems, so I'll read you a little love poem. It's called Bulbul, and Bulbul it means nightingale in Punjabi and in Urdu. Bulbul. Bulbul, don't look so nervous. I know the light can be brutal, but let me apply angled lines of sundur on your throat, along your breast, and dot your lifted brow. I imagine capturing you under my angle poise, Bulbul, coaxing your wings to flare and settle on my palm, deepening the colour of my hands. I watch you through the gap in the window screen. Your compacted heart receives the broken bread, whilst the rain nibbles at the blossom. You gaze at a bud, listening hard for a miracle. Does everybody know what an angle poise is? Because I read this a few weeks ago and someone came up to me and said, what's an angle poise? And they were very young, but I was just really surprised. I thought everybody knew what an angle poise was. I'll read one more bird poem and then a ballad. So this poem is called The Bird, and this is actually a poem about my mother. After my brother died and me being really concerned about her, and it sort of came to me in a dream about my mother sort of becoming a bird and sort of flying out the window. The bird. She's a prize forager. An assortment of beetle wings are arranged like shiny badges under her bed. Her mealworms have been freeze-dried with such care that they twitch in the bowl when resurrected with just a speck of water. She smells of preening oil, salt, top notes of earth. My mother is turning bird. This tiny impossible thing perched in my hand, molecules exciting her eyes, then the soft click, click that unlocks her humanity. She separates from the tips of my fingers, hops to the gap in the window, leaving complex glitter in my palm. Okay. I'm going to read, I'm going to be really annoying and read a poem that's new and not in the collection. And I want to tell you a little bit about it. It's a ballad. And in the book Small Hands, there's a ballad in the book called Ballad of the Small Bone Daughter. And it's a ballad about honour killing. And I don't want to read that today. But once I started... I discovered the ballad form and I started writing it. I realised that once you start writing a form which is sort of has a lot of music in it, it's quite difficult to get the music out of your head. And so I sort of ended up writing like quite a few ballads until the music went away. And there's one poem that that I wrote which is finished and I'd really like to share it with you. And it's called I Found a Tree Gin in the Lake. I'll explain to you what a gin is. A gin is, I suppose, like a fairy or a spirit. And it's very prevalent in my culture and also, I think, in Arabic culture as well. And it's sort of halfway between a human being and a spirit. So it has some status. And in the Quran, there is some mention of the gin as well. So this is, I found a tree gin in the lake, and then I'll finish. Oh, I just need to say one little thing, which is I use a little bit of Punjabi, which is a phrase, to bapis ja, which means go back home. I found a tree gin in the lake. I didn't know what was at stake. I laid his body in my lap, then tore away the filmy wrap and made to kiss his mouth once more to give him life, I wasn't sure. He woke and flew to a tree. Sodden he was, ruined with grief. The boy had wild and shining eyes. He gave out such pitiful sighs. His white face dazzled in the rain, marked by a variegated stain. His lungs in shreds, his tongue ablaze. I tried to reach him with my gaze. He glanced towards a branch that stirred and stretched to tap a burning bird. And when its perfume was released, I thought perhaps he'd find some peace. His eyelids closed, pale as death. Nothing now but his ragged breath. To Bapis Ja, I whisper in fear, and he begins to disappear. His bluish fingers clasp the bark, and he is absorbed in the dark. And so, as the night comes in, I make a gift of a bobby pin and lay the offering upon the ground as the leaf lands without a sound. I wish I had intruded more, the marbles on the forest floor, the boy gone now, my body quailing, and all around me, tree buds failing. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I forgot where I was just then. Had to remember, come back. To end the evening, Sarah Corbett will read from her fourth book called And She Was. When I asked her to describe it, she said, it's an experimental riff on the novel in verse. And She was written as part of a PhD in creative writing at Manchester University. Sarah's three previous collections with Saren Books are Other Beasts, 2008, The Witch Bag, 2002, and The Red Wardrobe, we're going backwards, 1998, which were shortlisted for a Forward Best First Collection Prize and also for the T.S. Eliot Prize. Sarah teaches creative writing for Lancaster University and lives in West Yorkshire.
Lights are really bright. Was that? Well, it's great to be here at Ledbury and to see you all here, or actually struggle to see you because I feel like I'm being blinded. When I was writing this book and people say, no, what are you writing? And I'm like, oh, I'm writing a verse novel. And people just sort of blank. Are you writing a novel? You know? And a lot of people sort of struggled with this sort of concept. And which is great, because the lovely thing about the verse novel is that it's very unfixed, I think, which was gave me a great sense of liberation to explore this, could call it a genre, if you want. And so I had a lot of fun with it and a lot of play with it. And I was very interested at the time. I was talking a lot at the time with a friend of mine who's a filmmaker. So there's a lot of filmic influence and reference throughout the book. And we were very interested in narrative and Jungian ideas about the collective unconscious and how you could create non-linear narrative and how far you could go with your audience or your readership in allowing them to kind of put the narrative together, if you like, for themselves, which I think is something that happens a lot in really good film and a lot in really good poetry. So I was interested in those ideas, and I was also interested in really pushing the idea of storytelling and narrative in poetry within the context of maintaining the lyric. So it was very much a kind of test and an experiment, which all sounds very complicated. But I think actually the book, if you approach the book as a love story, which is what it basically is, things get a little bit simpler. But it is a sort of puzzle, and it takes two stories which are sort of happening in a different part of the consciousness or a different time frame, but they're sort of happening at the same time, but they're also happening across time. If you like. I'm not going to say any more because I'm probably just making it more complicated. But you might also think of the Orpheus myth, of a kind of rewriting of the Orpheus myth. And the title, And She Was, comes from the Talking Heads song. And when I was asked for it, I had a really naff title when I was working on it. And Darren asked me to come up with a new title. And I came and I was kind of working through all sorts of possible variations on the original title and bits in the poem, and nothing was working. And all day, Talking Heads song, And She Was, which I hadn't heard or thought of for many years, was going around my head all day. And I thought, why is that song going around my head? And I thought, okay, here's a title. So the first poem in the book that I'm going to read is called E Major, and it's called E Major because actually Talking Heads song, And She Was, is in E Major. And you know that because of my son, who's a musician. E Major. And she was grist to his mill, and he was grit to her pearl, and she was salve to his burn, and he was soil to her furrow, and she was touch to his skin, and he was pulse to her beat, and she was cry to his voice, and he was wave to her shore, and she was roof to his wall, and he was chink to her glass, and she was a snake uncoiling from its burrow a long time underground, and he was a flower grown from a word dropped in soil, but a flower. And she was a glass blown from the lips of a child, an apprentice piece. and he was a crow plucking fur from the back of a horse for its nest, the horse purring. And she was a crow dropping a twig for her crow lover to catch, whirling and twirling. And he was a grain of sand waiting for a shell, waiting for an ear to fall into. And she was an ear listening to a wave in the mouth of a shell, an ear with an itch. And he was a hand buffing a jewel that was a grain of sand that was a pearl. And she was a grain grinding at his stone until her husk shed, and she was flour. And he was a flame eating up the curtains. And she was rain soaking through the rafters. And he was earth to her burrow, and she was hoof to his horse, and he was funk to her punk, and she was nipple to his navel, and he was lips to her glass, and she was stem to his flower, and he was scratch to her itch, and she was sky to his fall, and he was an ecstatic raindrop. And they were laughing and could not stop. So my two characters, there are two books in the book, and they kind of intercut and overlap. My two characters are two young people who meet on a train in the early hours of the morning. I'm going to read a poem called The Train, in which Esther, the female character, speaks, and Ian, the male character, speaks. They speak in alternating voices. The Train, Esther. Bands of night on the window collapse to black in the tunnel. A young man on the platform, the fire of him. Ian. Heathrow Express, my entry to the city compressed to the stutter of a tunnel. London, the darkest November yet. Stepping from the plane, wind clapped my jacket and rain found my neck. Night smoked like a bar after hours, and passengers drifted to cabs and relatives. A train draws in, relights at the platform. An empty carriage exhales its breath. Strip lights falter as I fold to a seat. My eyes double in the window's mirror. My hair blonde as when I was 12. Esther. I carry the time I've not yet done with. A year lost to the passes and bridges where a lord sits on the throne of your wrongs. The child in me, a girl with Eskimo hair, marsupial eyes, wrists like chicken bones, showed where the eel children split to the yellow fat, heel, split, heel. Ian. The island was a sunship in the Aegean. I stood on the ferry deck as the dock backed off like an affronted friend and the water unrolled its tongue. Cypress Hill, Orange Grove, White House above the bay, pearly tops of the town dipped below the waves. I wrote nothing those 3 months, slept, swam, sunbathed, but a story kept begging round and round. I had to face it each morning, souring coffee and rolls as the sun streamed by, a dog with one yellow eye, one turned in. Esther. I am in need of love, its cry, the genesis of cells, electricity in darkness, forks of pain. I return through shadows to this presence, the warmth of him, a wave on a screen. Ian. A click from the back of the carriage like the unclipping of a gun. My right shoulder cools. I clear my throat, pitch a confidence I do not feel. My left knee shakes at a glint, a rebound of neon, the distinct sound of a knife unsheathing. On the rack, my bags hunch down, wallet and phone press my pocket. I could turn, make clear my surrender. The tunnel goes on and on amid lucid flashes of strong colour. Esther. Leaning in, I see his face in the window, calf lashes, milk of his eye, a tail uncurls on my tongue. He is like looking at a lamp through skin. He is all the wants come home. Ian. Behind me, a shape takes up the aisle, whiff of lilacs, earth scent, ashes, the corners of my mother's garden. I turn, a cat stalks upright like a human. I blink, see again what I have seen, a young woman, something of the bed and the other bower about her, falling as if her eyes are too heavy for her head, her bones a burden. She tips towards me, pitiful and beautiful, a starved pet that has decided the life in her is stronger than the death. Kiss. Spider's knees at mine, legs agleam in black up to the thin black dress shucked at the hips. An opal eye on a chain between small high breasts as she straddles my lap, arches her back and flicks away long black hair. Hands icy and smooth, nails purple as if just pulled from a river, nip, feast, a cage of mice, 10 hungry fish. Her iris black, her lids purple, her tongue a minnow between my teeth, darts from my throat with its tip. So our two characters meet on a train and kiss. So the one of the books is The Runner, and in The Runner we meet a character called Felix Morning, who wakes on the back street of a sort of unreal city, if you like, with no memory of who he is or how he got there. The cafe. On a side street, in the gap before dawn, a man lies in a puddle of overcoat left like a prop from the night show, a man thrown from another world. Static on air like a coming storm, lights of the city faltering out. The first bars of Beethoven's Fifth play from folds of cloth, and the man pulls to all fours like a horse falling upwards on film, stares at the machine on his wrist ticking under the tinny symphony, taps it to silence, turns hands like a pair of new gloves, and rubs a roundel of skin on a finger that is a band of satin, thinks, what has been taken? That blind touch to the face, cheekbones, cheeks, stubble, chin, waits for the dream to reveal itself, waits and cobbles press knees, heart pushes at throat, neck aches with holding still. This is no dream that I can think, hurt, feel. All is dark shapes on dark shapes. He is one of them. So a young woman turns up, and she says to him, well, I'm glad you made it, Felix, and, you know, you're going to meet me tonight at the bunker. And he's kind of like, okay, and he's just having to sort of, he doesn't know who this person is that he's supposed to be, and he's just having to sort of go along with things. But in between, he kind of heads off to a place called The Garden, and the idea of The Garden, something that I come back to, I think, in my work, and it's certainly something I'm working with a lot, actually, in stuff I'm writing at the moment. And obviously you'll recognize it from Paradise Lost, perhaps, which is the wings of Paradise Lost are perhaps behind this book a little bit as well. So Felix heads off, and he doesn't know who he is. He's got kind of little clues. He can't remember anything. And he's really just following his nose. The Garden. Felix checks the watch that woke him. 6 o'clock. A blue light winks above the dial. It is an ugly watch, he thinks, not something I would have chosen. The strap is supple and sits with ease behind his wrist. Shakes off thoughts of who has chosen it for him. Who am I to choose anything? Felix Morning, a trick, a ghost, a flippity gibbet. As he leaves the cobbled street, the light shifts. not just the movement from alley to avenue, but a distinct moment like the moving on of time, as if a paler lens has slipped into place. The sky unfolds its rinsed linen over white houses, set back from swept pavements and iron gates, a guard of London plane and silver birch spangled with frost. Felix no longer sees the corner where Stan's cafe waits. Does Stan go back on his wheels into the clock? This grand silent street stretches from one horizon to the next. One of those locked gardens occurs between two mansions, bookended in marble strained through rain and ochre of rust, unkempt behind peeled railings, two of which have been forced to admit a dog or me. Felix folds concertina style into the gap. I know this place, the hydrangeas and lilacs, the gone wild roses. Flowers on the path release a perfume where he treads, and he is 6 years old, pelting through rhododendron tunnels, tangle of unburied limbs he rumbles with a stick. A drumming from above answers his music, earth rising in his nostrils, petals along the rose walk, a garden of bruises like the five-finger bruise that will darken on his thigh when mother's hand snapped like a whip. It is a dream he trips into, then forgets. Ivy bends around a bench under a used black apron where he finds a holdall disguised with leaves and inside two blankets from childhood, my childhood, rubs with a lurch the milky edge. Sweatshirt, socks, woolen hat infused with musk, this smell, his smell, better than memory. He piles them on, knows that cold will bite like a beaten dog. What else does he know? Bed of blankets? Fist for a pillow, breathing into the well of self until a mimic of sleep that is a boat hitched to a stump bumping against the bank. But first he takes out the black card in his pocket. The face in the photo, he has to admit, is what he saw in the cafe window, but the name doesn't fit. Felix Morning? It sounds made up. Long legs in black trousers, bony wrists and pianist fingers. Feet in trainers like sprung pads. Okay, I can buy cat. But morning, what have I lost? The name of a place, the bunker, a club of which he is a member. In the small print beneath his name, he is the runner. And the address, Solomon's Wharf, of which he has also never heard. The napkin map scrawled in a hand that might be his shows a path to a river, a cross that marks a bridge. The back of the card is a hologram, a dragon around a dancing woman. His hands fall apart. He forgets about his forgetting. Sleep now, and later he'll meet Flick, perhaps at the cross over the river. A river surely is not hard to find. So I'm going to leave Felix there. And if you want to find out what happens to him, you'll have to buy the book and read it. So the second story, if you like, returns to the two characters, Esther and Ian, and picks up the story of their love affair. So they're young, two young people who each believe that they have lost something essential, but they can't quite put their finger on what it is. And in that very naive way, believe that the other person can replace that thing in themselves. And this is their fallacy, if you like, the thing that they have to work out. I think. How much time have I got? 2 minutes? Crikey. Okay, right. I'm just going to end on something really rude, actually. There's a, I think you probably noticed a theme in all of our work, obviously intense lyricism and an interest in eroticism, sexuality, and writing really as women poets in quite a transgressive way, in a way that might bring criticism, a criticism that we invite, I think, so then we can argue back. And obviously, central to any love story is sex. And so I'm just going to leave you with some sexy poems about their first nights together. Nights together. He pricks his way into my shell. Small movements, softnesses, My whole skin shines. He turns me over, my body to his. I slide between palms as he slides in me. She takes my hands and parts her folds with my fingers, her raised clit a pearl. She is a continent, its rift, and from here its heat, her mouth, her cunt. Surge of a horse in my back, the animal's earth and tendon, stretch, gather, lift. Flashes of cord and vine, grape and the blood, thud in the womb, galloping. She wraps around me, eels slippery. I arch in, her mouth open. She wants two of me. Swing to my last, thumb on her lip, fist her hair, tip her over. Deep kisses, tongue's roots, teeth in them, on lips and soft tugs. We bend, snail twist from branches in our mouths, dew drip. Firm at the neck, spines from fishes, bodies slither and wriggle. It is a relief to gasp and die, a trail of plasma, the glitter of cells on my hands. Slow now, mount, as the blood keeps, and hold the cum slippery, hard, and hold fingers to me, hard and whole, while the world flower empties its stars. Thank you.